Depression isn't all tears and suicide letters, although both of these do appear in my story. It affects each of its victims differently and has no one-size-fits-all. For me, just one of the 350 million people who suffer worldwide, it's the unexplainable black cloud which envelopes every part of my life. Those words are included in the opening sentences from the book The Unseen Battle, One Young Footballer's Struggle Off the Pitch. It's a story that allows the reader an all-access look at depression and what it is like to deal with, and it's not pretty. The author of that book is 19-year-old Ruth Fox, who is currently playing for Cambridge United. A matter of months ago, Ruth was writing her suicide letter in preparation to end her life. What followed instead was a series of brave blog posts before someone suggested she should put the ebook together. Her life has now completely transformed, and she has found her purpose in telling people exactly what it is like to manage the dark cloud that is depression. In this podcast episode, we hear all about Ruth and her story as we delve into mental health and the complex ways it can damage your brain. We also look at the help on offer, but also just what sport is able to do. Essentially, it can be a lifesaver. Ruth, thanks so much for coming on to our podcast and being part of our mental health awareness specials. Obviously, you've been doing the rounds on social media now because of your book, The Unseen Battle, One Young Footballer's Struggle Off the Pitch. So, see, it's something that's very passionate for you. But before we dive into this whole mental health aspect, let's kind of talk about you and your sport first.
Yep.
So I'll start off with a very general, generic question in that, how do you describe how important football is to you?
I think, to be honest, football's like saved my life on several occasions. So pretty important, to be honest.
Pretty powerful as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's always, since I was about like 7 years old, it's always been my go-to. I think it didn't matter that I was a girl. I still like loved the game. You know, I used to play with my dad at the field. I used to beat him all the time when we did like one-on-ones. It was just sort of my place to be myself and to, you know, I felt really confident with the ball at my feet, and I still do, and it's the only place where I can be 100% myself. So for me, football, you know, is kind of my life, and yeah, as I said, it saved my life on several occasions, so yeah, it's pretty important to me.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll obviously delve now into kind of your story and the mental health aspect, and it all kicked off when you were 14, I think.
Yeah.
So how did it start, essentially, and what was going through your head at the time?
Yeah, so, I mean, I've always been, like, a high achiever, a lover of life. Like, I didn't have a worry in the world at all. So, yeah, when I was about 14, my sister went to uni, and I just found that change in my life really hard to deal with. It's not, at the time, I didn't realise it was because of that. But having that person taken away from me, who especially was really close to me, was just hard to deal with. And I also picked up a little injury at the same time, so I couldn't play football, I couldn't go running, I couldn't do sport, I couldn't therefore, you know, get that release that I needed, and it just sent me into a downward spiral. I didn't understand why, once my injury had recovered, my head was still in a really bad place, because I thought the two, you know, coincided. And yeah, I was really confused. I'd never come across mental illness before. I didn't know what depression was. The only time I'd ever used the word was like, oh, the weather is depressing, which, you know, I don't use that phrase now. But, yeah, I was, you know, when I was diagnosed with depression, you know, by the doctor, I was kind of in a little bit of shock. I didn't know what it was. I thought anything to do with mental, you know, someone should be locked up and they were crazy. And, you know, my whole understanding of mental health was heightened by, you know, having that diagnosis, which, to be honest, like, completely changed my life.
You mentioned the turning point kind of being your sister going off to university. How close were the two of you?
Incredibly, incredibly close. I think we're really different. Like, I've got a really competitive drive inside me, and you know, really sporty, and she's more of sort of a people person, like really caring, really sociable. But I think because we're so different, we're kind of, you know, opposites attract and all that, and you know, we just got on really well. We've got the same sense of humour. We just find the randomest things hilarious and laugh for hours. And I think, you know, if I did have any problems, she would be the first person I go to. So to have a huge problem, which was kind of caused by her, but not obviously on purpose, was really hard because I then had no one to go to. And, you know, I don't like being the centre of attention, so this stuff is hard because I don't like being the centre of attention. But so for, you know, for me to suddenly be like an only child as such, you know, at home and having three of us around the dinner table as opposed to four, I just found it a very difficult environment. And yeah, we're incredibly close now. Like, I still, you know, call her my best friend and definitely a role model for me. And yeah, I didn't know that her leaving would have such a big impact on me, to be honest.
Did people notice a change in you? Because so you mentioned in your book that you're this bubbly persona. Mm-hmm. And you can see it now as well. did people notice that it was a change in your mood at all?
I think initially I didn't even want to go to school, I think. So you know, I wasn't in school for a little while. I had to continue going into school just to keep the structure going. And even though personally I don't think I should have been in school, I went into school, sat with the school nurse for a while, then went home again. I didn't have any lessons or anything, so people didn't really see me for a while. And I also lost a lot of weight at the time. Just, you know, was overtraining, wasn't eating enough. I enjoyed having that control over that. So I think that's the thing that people picked up on the most, the sort of physical symptoms. Like, my face was always really sort of like white and colourless. And I think, you know, I just didn't get the enjoyment out of things. And I think people noticed that when, you know, I wasn't really socialising with my friends. And to be honest, I did try and just cover it up. And when I was in lessons, when I finally like started going back to lessons, you know, I'd do one lesson a day and then I'd, you know, progress up to doing six lessons again. I just sat down, got my head down and just like worked. And I didn't, you know, tried not to look at the social side of school because that was really challenging for me. So I just, people saw my grades, I guess, as an indicator of how well I was doing. And my grades stayed the same. And therefore, noticing that anything was wrong in my head was difficult for people to see. And as I said, like, you know, I put on, you know, quite a mask that I was kind of ashamed of going through something. And when I came back from school, you know, I didn't tell people, oh, I've been off school because I was depressed. I just said I was ill. You know, I was ashamed of what I'd gone through at that period of time. And yeah, I think people struggled to know that anything was up. So I think when I finally did open up to people, which I did in 2015, I shared my story at my school sports awards. And, you know, I think a lot of people in that room who heard my story were very, very shocked because, you know, no one had known what I'd been through. And I think that's the most important thing for me about everything is, you know, it's a silent illness. And, you know, you can never know what's going on inside someone else's head.
You say you don't like being the centre of attention. And then suddenly on that day, you're revealing this to everyone.
Yeah.
And kind of letting your guard down for the first time.
Absolutely.
That must have been an incredibly daunting day and thing to do.
Yeah. I was kind of slightly excited, but yeah, obviously incredibly apprehensive. I just thought that was the right thing to do. I basically made a video. It's just a really short video, kind of showing my journey from, you know, athlete. You know, I played hockey, I played football. You know, losing a load of weight, being diagnosed, going on medication, and then, you know, sort of rebuilding my life again after that, and then announcing I'd be playing football again because I'd quit football when things were really tough. So. You know, after that, I got approached by my hockey teacher and she said, like, we want to share this video at the Sports Awards. And, you know, I was excited because I just wanted people to know where I'd come from and you know, that it hadn't been easy and that what everyone was seeing on the outside wasn't the full picture. So I think that night, you know, remains my absolute proudest moment. You know, the applause that I received that night was, you know, it still gives me goosebumps, like, today. And I think, yeah, it took a lot to be able to do that and to share it in front of so many people. But it was entirely worth it. And, you know, it makes the stuff I'm doing now a lot easier because, you know, the response I got from that was really heartwarming. And, you know, it's kind of made me want to continue to do what I do because, you know, I'm not ashamed of what I've been through. It doesn't make a difference to who I am as a person. And if it does, you know, only adds to my character. So I think it was obviously a really, really hard step to make, but one that was definitely worth it.
at that time, mm-hmm. where was the help for you and the support, and where did you find it?
When I was 14, I was put on medication, so I was put on fluoxetine, and after about 3, 4, 5 weeks, that sort of pulled me back from that dark place and kind of put me on like an even keel. I was on that medication for about a year and a bit, although it doesn't really feel like that. It felt like I was on it for like 3 weeks and it kind of saved everything. But I didn't have any like ongoing therapy because waiting lists were too long. I used the gym as a real safe space to get rid of all my angst and sort of frustrations at what was going on inside my head, and I kind of used that as a personal focus and a way of developing myself, and obviously the drive that I got from doing stuff in the gym and pushing myself in that way, you know, it's the same drive that you have to use to get yourself out of a really dark depressive episode, I guess. So I think, yeah, medication, to be honest, really did help me at that time and got me to a place where I felt more stable in myself. I think everyone around me sort of found it very, very difficult to deal with. You know, a few of my friends, I've recently spoken to them about that time, and I think one of my friends went back to her mum one day and said, like, Ruth doesn't like me anymore. Like, she's not talking to me. She's become this sort of reclusive, you know, person who doesn't talk to people. And I think for a lot of us, depression was something that we'd never come across, and it was a very difficult thing to come to terms with, like my parents as well. So at that period of time, medication worked for me and got me to a more stable place, I think.
Yeah, and we'll fast forward on a little bit because mm-hmm. you kind of recovered. I don't want to say recovered because it's not really something you can recover from.
Yeah.
But you found yourself in a happier place, but then
absolutely.
There's a relapse.
Yeah.
Later on.
Yeah.
Was there a trigger behind that?
Yeah, I personally think so. My nan went into hospital. She'd like fractured her hip in quite a nasty fall, and I just found like seeing someone that you love in a vulnerable position just very, very challenging. I kind of, obviously it was like fear of loss, like, which was kind of similar to my sister going to uni. You know, I kind of lost her to university, and it was just, yeah, that feeling of vulnerability and powerlessness. You know, it just brought it all back, and honestly I thought depression was something that you only got once, because obviously I'd never come across it before. I thought, do you know what, I've been through that. It was really, really hard. I've learned a lot from it. That's it. I never have to do like go through that ever again. So I think that's why my relapse personally was so difficult to deal with.
Reading that part in your book,
yeah,
it sounds a lot more severe than the first episode.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what was it about it that made it so much worse in your head?
I don't think it was like the trigger that was particularly worse or anything like that. I think it was just because I was more emotionally mature and like I knew what I was capable of, and I think I just felt emotionally a lot more with it, but that kind of had a negative impact.
Was it maybe frustration that you know you can do all these things,
yeah.
so you're questioning yourself, why is my brain acting in this way?
Absolutely. I think you feel like something's holding you back, but like you have no idea like why it's holding you back, or you feel like it's unfair. And I think frustration is definitely the right word. I think for me as well, I was in denial for quite a long period of time. Like I kind of put it, like the way I was feeling, I put it down to academic stress. I was studying for 3 A-levels hard, and I kind of was just like, oh, it's just academic stress, and I kind of kept pushing it away and pushing it away, until one day I kind of thought, do you know what, this isn't okay. It was really hard to come to terms with it again, and to kind of associate that word with me again, because I thought I'd done that and I didn't have to go through that again. I wrote in my book that, you know, it felt like I'd been diagnosed with cancer, and I think that's a really harsh way of putting it, but that was my reality at the time. That's what it felt like for me. So yeah, it was just incredibly challenging
in that you thought you'd beaten it before,
yeah,
and then suddenly it's back,
yeah,
worse than ever.
Yeah.
Was there kind of an element of feeling like you'd failed a little bit, and that because you've given this amazing speech to all these people,
yeah,
relatively recently,
yeah,
and then suddenly you're back at square one.
Yeah, absolutely. It felt like I'd taken taken so many steps backwards that all of that stuff didn't matter because I was back where I started anyway. I think it took I didn't understand it at all. I didn't understand, you know, why it had come back, and yeah, it was incredibly difficult to come to terms with it. And yeah, I felt like a failure in that, you know, especially because I was so open about my experiences. I thought, because I thought I'd beaten it, and I thought I'd made a full and like conclusive recovery. That's that, you know, move on, go and achieve what you know you can achieve, which was, you know, 3 A's at A level and off to uni. Like, so for me, it was challenging to almost go back to square one, but almost further down than I was before, because things got a lot deeper and darker.
I kind of want to touch on your biology teacher now as well, because I know you obviously had a very close relationship with him.
Yeah.
And he was kind of your sounding board for a lot of your issues that you were having at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. he just devoted like a stupid amount of time to me. Like, he went above and beyond like what a teacher would normally offer. Like, a lot of teachers, you know, their job is to teach you biology, obviously, like he, like his job was. But, you know, for him, he treated me as a person and not just as a student. Like, I felt like, you know, he'd make me a cup of tea and we'd just chat, and I felt like we were on the same level. He wasn't above me just because he was my teacher. We were person on person, human being to human being, not teacher to student. And I felt he was always the go-to person. If I had a really rough day, I'd just drop him an email and go and chat to him. Even in my meetings with my head of sick form and my tutor, he wasn't my tutor, he was only my biology teacher, but he was always in those meetings. Like, it was almost as if my parents, my head of year, my tutor were all on one side of the table and me and him were on the other side. I felt like someone was on my side with me, and you know, sometimes I'd break down in those meetings and found them really tough, but he'd always be the person that was able to, you know, bring me up to a place where I'd be able to talk. And and if I couldn't talk, then he knew what I wanted to say anyway. And yeah, I think he's had more of an impact on me than I think he'll ever accept or anyone will ever know. I think just the amount of time that he devoted to me, I didn't feel like I was worth any time, to be honest. Like, I just felt really weak and sort of powerless and not achieving what I should have achieved and whatever. But, you know, he saw me as the bubbly year 12 that he taught me as, and, you know, he's always been the one that's thanked me for opening his eyes up to mental illness and to what students could be going through, and for being, you know, that bubbly person in year 12 and the contrast. And you know, it always surprises me, because, you know, I'm the one that should be thanking him, and I do thank him quite often, and I still meet him now, which is lovely. But yeah, I think, you know, one day he emailed, you know, on Christmas Day he emailed me and checked up on how I was. And, you know, that's a day when you spend with your family, and obviously it's challenging when you're in a bad place. It's hard to socialise with people, and I found Christmas incredibly difficult. But, you know, he still had time for me then. He emailed me and checked in on how I was, and I think that says a lot about his character. And, you know, I think there should be more of my biology teachers in the world, just people who are willing to listen, and professional boundaries go out the window, because, you know, we're all human beings and we're all on this journey together, and I think everyone needs that person in their life who's willing to listen to them, because it can have a world of difference.
Hearing you talk about Christmas and that period, I think that was one of the many striking things in your book.
Yeah.
Is having to deal with Christmas, because it's traditionally this happy time.
Yeah.
No one can possibly understand why you'd be depressed at Christmas.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think any time of year, you know, depression doesn't just disappear. You know, I think two things Christmas sort of, you know, is almost known for, you know, being happy and being grateful. And those two things I couldn't even be. Like, I thought receiving, in this point in my head, I was like, you know, this is stupid. We're just receiving presents that in 6 months' time they'll be just chucked in a drawer. And, you know, they're just materialistic load of rubbish. Like, I just was in such a bad place that, you know, even on Christmas Day I'd go out and make all the teas and coffees and cut the cake, and, like, on my own, and go and do that on my own, because I wanted to get away from people. And I think you know, I think we're very keen to associate Christmas with all these positive things, but, you know, you never know what people are going through. I'll reiterate that again, and I think, you know, people don't have loved ones who were once there at Christmas, and that's another challenging thing. But for me, just the social side of it, and having to be happy, because, you know, it's a time of being with your family, and you're receiving all these amazing presents and whatever. And, you know, depression doesn't care about that. It's, you know, it's as hard a day as anything else, if not harder. And yeah, I think, you know, Christmas was a really, really challenging time for me, and I think for my family as well.
Obviously, there's the depressive side of things, and it's all in the head. But then what makes this particular period of your life even more challenging is that it develops into self-harming.
Yeah.
And then suicidal thoughts.
Yeah.
Was there a reason it kind of took that angle, whereas it didn't before?
Yeah. I think with self-harm, it's never something I'd done before. But I think I described it as, like, I was feeling numb of my emotions, like, entirely. That's how it made me feel. And I kind of just needed to feel some kind of pain. So I think that's what initially sparked me to turn to that coping mechanism, I guess. I wasn't proud to be doing that, and I wasn't... I recognise it wasn't a good thing to do, but for me, it kind of just... That's a kind of pain that I needed and I craved. And it was a physical pain as opposed to an emotional pain. And, you know, that was a... To me, that was a good thing. I mean, it didn't release anything. I mean, for a lot of people, it releases a lot, and that's why they do it. But for me, it just sort of highlighted the pain, and for me, that was the main reason. And yeah, like, sort of later on, I would do that sort of every night, all over my body, like, quite severely. But I recognized it didn't solve anything, and it didn't help me cope in any way better. It just kind of turned into sort of part of my routine, and I think I was turning it on myself, like I was almost punishing myself for how I was feeling, which is terrible, obviously, but it just felt like the right thing to do at the time. And in terms of suicidal thoughts, they're like some of the most scary things I think that have ever happened. I think when you start to have visualizations of ways that you can end your life, like it's very distressing, and it's hard to deal with, especially when they're so vivid and so clear. You kind of feel like you're being forced into this corner, and you know, there's only one way out of it. And I'm incredibly grateful that I didn't go through with the so many plans that I'd had in my head. And yeah, I just hope that in sharing my story, you know, it can help pull someone else out from that point.
Absolutely. Previously, you've been able to keep all these thoughts in your head, mm-hmm. kind of hidden from a lot of people.
Yeah.
But obviously, with self-harming and things like that, mm-hmm. there's signs, there's telltale signs on your wrists.
Uh-huh.
And you mentioned that time when your parents noticed these. How did they deal with it? But also, how do you deal with them knowing that you're going through this and you're doing this to yourself?
Yeah. I think I was actually going to tell my parents. I planned on telling them when I was ready, to be honest. But yeah, I think I was like wearing a dressing gown one night, and yeah, my dad happened to see my scars on my wrist, and he just collapsed to his knees, and I think was in shock, really, that I'd, you know, done that to myself. And he reacted in a very distressing way, and he also acted in a very practical way, and, you know, got onto ringing NHS 111, getting me support and taking me to A&E. I think they found it hard to deal with. You know, no one likes to see anyone harming themselves, especially if it's your own sort of daughter. But I think for me, it was almost a good thing, because it sort of showed how much pain I was in, and that I decided to take it out on myself. Sort of, you know, that spoke a thousand words for me. But I think, you know, if you've not been through it, it's very difficult to gauge an understanding of what it's like, what's going on in your head. So, you know, my parents I found very difficult to talk to about it, because they don't have that emotional understanding. And, you know, I chose other people to go talk to, like my biology teacher and whatever. So, yeah, I think choosing the right people to talk to is massively important. And, yeah, clearly it was distressing for them. But to be honest, at the time, I didn't really think about them at all. I think depression makes you turn very selfish and only think about your own problems and only think about what's inside your own head. So I didn't think once about, you know, well, the impact it had on the people around me, and clearly it had a, you know, a horrific impact on them as well. So yeah,
in terms of gauging and understanding as well about what's going through your head, and this is the bit that stuck out for me by far and away the most, is the suicide letter that you wrote, and the full letter is in the book as well.
Yeah.
And reading that, it really hammers home just that sense of worthlessness that you have in yourself. Mm-hmm. Why was it so important to you to share that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, clearly that was the hardest thing I've ever had to write in the moment, but putting that in my story as I wrote the entire story was, for me, one of the most important things, because, you know, if I didn't write that, it felt like I was in denial that never happened, and it did happen, and to get it down was hard, and I knew a lot of people would find it, well, most people would find it distressing and hard to read, but I just wanted, you know, to be as real and as honest as possible. And I think you can never have, like, that could be anyone going through that, you know, that could be anyone's, you know, teenagers spend a lot of awful lot of time in their rooms upstairs and whatever, and you know, that could be anyone's children, you know, and it's just horrific. And you know, I just want people to be made aware of what can be going on behind closed doors, and how deep and dark things really got, and how close I was to taking my own life. You know, I genuinely saw that as my only way out. So, although it was hard to include and hard to go public about it, that's the reality of what happened to me, and I wanted to be 100% honest with that.
What was it that stopped you taking that final action?
It's a good question, and one that I get asked a lot. I think at the time, I planned it all out. I was going to jump in front of a train the following morning. So I wrote the suicide letter in the evening, slept, and then as soon as I got out of bed, that was going to be my only action for the day. I'd made no plans for because that's all I was going to do. I stayed in bed for as long as I could, because that was kind of prolonging what time I had left, I guess. And it was a knock at the door which kind of took my head away from that dark moment. And my mum was just asking if I wanted a coffee. I didn't want to leave the house because I was just really scared. Obviously, my parents had no idea what was going on. So I was like, oh, can you bring me one back? Because, you know, I still wanted a coffee. I mean, who wouldn't? I mean, we're sitting in Costa now, like.
Exactly.
So I was like, yeah, go on then. And, you know, she brought me back a coffee. And I think, you know, it's not like I spewed out everything that was happening there and then, because I didn't. It wasn't until a few weeks later that I actually told her, you know, how dark things had got. But I think it was that moment of, one, distraction. You know, a lot of people say, you know, that's why Samaritans is there, because it's a distraction away from that really intense period. You know, that's why people say to, like, take time out for about 20 minutes, because it makes your head go away from whatever you're thinking about. And that distraction of having that knock on the door, that moment of kindness that people cared about me, despite not knowing what I was going through, they still cared about me enough to pop their head in and ask me if I wanted a coffee. So I think those two things were pivotal in pulling me away from that dark place. And once I'd kind of, you know, slowly gotten away from that moment, I was then able to, you know, get through the next few days and the next few weeks, and start to rebuild and start to reflect and start to, you know, sort of really come to terms with the point at which I was and how close I'd come. And and as I said, start to attempt to rebuild my life from that moment.
Turning to the help and support aspect, mm-hmm. and it strikes me that while in theory it's there, the structures are in place, practically it's not actually. Because there's been several occasions when you needed the help for whatever reason, and it wasn't given to you or wasn't given to you in the right way.
Yeah.
And you being just discharged from hospital, for example, uh-huh. and then suddenly all ties are cut and you're kind of left on your own all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Was that incredibly hard to deal with? And is that something that really needs to change as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I was discharged from hospital, I was, you know, meant to have continual support. Because clearly, you know, not everything's absolutely perfect when you get discharged. But because I moved counties, so I moved from Hertfordshire to Bedfordshire, like 20 miles up down the A1. I rang them up and said, look, can I have an appointment, blah, blah, blah. And they said, you know, we can't support you now because we're in a different county. And I just sort of, from that moment, I was left completely on my own. You know, I'd been discharged two days earlier from, you know, acute care in hospital, you know, following obviously severe suicidal thoughts. And it's actually, you know, after I was discharged from hospital that I wrote my suicide letter and I reached my lowest point. So that in itself, you know, says a lot. I think medication is dished out, you know, willy nilly, and you know, it's not a cure. It's just sort of you know, covering up the symptoms maybe, and not helping to just like sort out the underlying issues as to why you feel like that. For me, I've had like countless moments when, you know, I've been let down by people. Like, I called an ambulance one night and they refused to send one out to me, even though I was, you know, severely suicidal. I stood by a road for 2 hours, you know, contemplating jumping in front of a car. And when you're in a bad place already, to have people let you down is just makes things even worse. And I think that's why I got to the point that I did, because, you know, you put a lot of trust and faith in the services and that they're going to give you the support that you need to get on with your life and to recover from whatever you're going through. But for me, I just felt let down like a lot of the time, and, you know, I feel like that's purely down to resources that's lacking. And I think just an understanding of what it feels like to be in my situation, and to suddenly have, as you say, like all ties are cut and you're completely abandoned and left on your own, you know, it's a horrendous place to be. So I think a lot needs to change, definitely.
And some of that medication you talk about,
yeah,
had adverse effects.
Yeah.
And you kind of expect when you're taking these tablets that, yeah, this is supposed to boost your mood.
I think the ironic thing about a lot of antidepressants, especially in under 18s, is, you know, the prominent side effect is suicidal thoughts. So it's like taking, you know, a painkiller for a headache and having a severe migraine. It's just so adverse and so scary as well. I mean, you take something, for me especially, like, medication worked the first time and, you know, I didn't get any side effects and that was great. But, you know, I took the same medication twice after when I was about 17, and you know, it sent me to A&E. It gave me severe suicidal thoughts, and, you know, we need to be made aware of these side effects. And yeah, especially in under 18s, I think we all assume that medication will be the answer. It's a quite comforting thing, but I think we need to address the underlying problems, and medication is a great way of bringing someone up to that point where they're able to talk and they're in a more stable position. But, you know, I think it's a really scary place to be, to know that, you know, something which is meant to help you has actually caused you to feel worse. It's a scary place to be.
Obviously now things are a lot better. Mm-hmm. You're managing things a lot better.
Yeah.
What were the key aspects in helping you kind of improve your situation?
I think taking it day by day has been a real key driver in getting me to a better place. Not looking too far ahead. If you have a bad day, that's fine. You know, some days are bad days. Some days you don't do anything. Some days you can't do anything, and that's okay. You know, we're all, you know, we love to be productive and we all love to get as much done as we possibly can. But, and it's hard for me because I know I've got potential to go and do stuff. And it's hard when I have to have days where I don't do anything because I feel like I'm not reaching my full potential and stuff. But, you know, that's okay. And it's accepting that. I think self-acceptance is another key thing. Learning about myself, like, I've not had that ongoing psychological support because I've just not been offered it. I'm not on any medication because, again, you know, the professionals haven't been great with that. So I think learning a lot about myself, learning about the people around you, how they deal with the depression, how I deal with it. I think having the right people to go talk to if you need to. Like, I've had a lot of people around me who are always up for having a chat if I need it, like to go grab a coffee if I'm having a bad day or whatever. And surround yourself with people who you know are going to be there in the darkest times, because it's funny, you know, when you post something about, you know, going on Sky Sports, which, you know, I was on a month or so ago, like, the amount of people that, you know, congratulate you and say well done and oh wow, whatever. And you know, you then think about the people that were there in November when I was feeling at my lowest. You know, those are the people that you need to stick by. And, you know, it's really hard to do, but you need to be a person that sticks by people in their darkest times. Then you have the right to celebrate the good times with them. Because we all love congratulating people and, you know, rewarding their successes. But, you know, we've got to stand by people's side in their darkest times, because, you know, I think that shows, you know, a true person, a true friend.
And you're going around now kind of sharing your story, but it all kick-started with the book.
Yeah.
How did that come about? When was it about just getting your thoughts down on paper as quickly as possible?
Yeah, I think I didn't really think about it at the time. I just sat on my laptop and just wrote and just got it down from, you know, being a happy-go-lucky kid to you know, where I was now and the journey and, you know, just wanted to get it down. I mainly wanted to get it down to talk about the self-harm, to talk about the suicide letter, to talk about the suicidal thoughts, because no one else knew about all of that. There was not one person in my circle of support that knew all of that stuff. And I didn't write it to share it with them. I wrote it for myself, just for my own sort of clarity, to sort of show that, you know, these things did happen. You're not making this up. Your head isn't making these things up. They actually happened. And to write it down, took it off my shoulders and put it onto a piece of paper. And for me, that was really cathartic to do. And yeah, and then I shared it with my parents, who were obviously shocked by some of the parts of it. And I also shared it with my coach, who, you know, said it should reach a further audience. You know, there were parts in that could resonate with a lot of people. And that's the thing that drove me to getting it published on Amazon, is, you know, all the fears I had of exposing myself just went out the window, because I thought, you know, if I can help somebody who's in that dark place that I describe in my book, it's entirely worth it for whatever, really.
And the response you've had as well since it was published has been immense, and that must be something you feel so proud about.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I feel proud. I think I find it hard to associate the story with me, because it's kind of like, yeah, I feel proud of my story, but I don't really feel proud of me. I don't know why, I just don't. But yeah, I mean, the response has been so overwhelming. You know, the number of comments and the number of sales as well. Like, it's been incredible, and just makes me want to reach a wider audience and reach as many people as possible. I think, you know, mental health isn't spoken about enough, and if it is, then not enough is done. So yeah, we're happy to talk about it, but we never do anything more than that. But I want to actually change things, and I want to actually make an impact, and, you know, leave a legacy, and you know, that's what I aspire to do. So yeah.
And in terms of changing things, it was something we talked about in great depth before we started recording this, and that's kind of the amount of stress that is put on people in school at a very young age.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I suppose, was that something that you felt really impacted on you when you were going through all of your tough times?
Yeah, I think in the back of my head there was always, you're a high achiever, you got 9 A stars and 2 A's in your GCSEs, you should get 3 A's at A-level, you should go to uni. You know, partly because of the school I went to a private school, but also partly because I put a lot of pressure on myself. I come from a family of high achievers as well, and I just assumed that was the only way you could go into the world, is through uni. Like, that was the one-way system, and that's the only way you could go. And so yeah, I think I felt a lot of disappointment when I wasn't able to complete my A-levels and wasn't able to go to uni. And I think, you know, there's so much pressure on young people to you know, to work so hard and to get the grades that, you know, perhaps if they'd got slightly lower grades, they would be more rounded people, you know, have time for other things, develop as a person, as opposed to just being this academic robot that, you know, has very little personal skills. And for me, like, this year, I'm not going to get any qualifications. I'm mental health first aid trained. That's about the only qualification I've got. But I don't really care, because, you know, I'm going to have a book published in paperback. I've met some truly inspiring people, and, you know, having an impact on people in my everyday life, which, you know, if I was at uni, I'd probably just be drunk right now, like, or recovering from the night before. And I think so much pressure is put on young people to follow this straight line. And, you know, I want to be someone who, you know, turns the rudder of that boat and says, you know what, I'm going to go on my own path and try and succeed in my own way. And I think that's one of my key messages is do things your way. You know, I've learned so much about myself and so much about mental health and so much about other people, you know, more so than I would have ever done doing my A-levels or going to uni.
Exactly. Is that, I suppose, a couple of the main pointers that you kind of want to change are the fact that success, academic success, is so often judged on grades, rather than you actually being a person and a well-rounded person.
Yep.
And also a school's commitment or a university's commitment to you after you leave class. Yeah. They're kind of, that's it, ties are cut until you're back in the next day.
That's it.
Is that something that really needs to change?
Yeah, I think so. I think my biology teacher, for example, like, you know, is a really good example of that. You know, after school finished at 4 o'clock, you know, he'd be happy to email me at 7 p.m. that night if I had a question or wanted to unload something to him. Or, as I said about Christmas Day, you know, that's obviously in the holidays. I think, yeah, you know, the system is very refined to to you're in school this period of time. Once you leave at this in the summer or whatever, that's it. You're done. And I think, you know, if you treat someone as a person and not as a student, then you know they need support in whatever step they next take, and there should always be links there. And yeah, I think if more people did that, they'd realise what an impact that person can have on the teacher, but also vice versa. I think the whole education system, you know, is very academic based, obviously. But you know, are we trying to create the person with 4A stars, or are we trying to create the person who's got skills for every single everyday life? And you know, we don't learn about tax, we don't learn about finance, we don't learn about car insurance, or you know, how to cook or anything like that. You know, the skills that you need in everyday life, we're just not told about. Yet we're taught about, you know, finding the area of a triangle or whatever, which we never use in day-to-day life. And I think, you know, we need to learn about these things, because we want you know, a generation where, you know, we're prepared for the future. And you know, there will be less, I believe, less mental health issues, because you know, not everything's as daunting, because you know, sometimes you need to put things into perspective, and you know, maybe dropping a grade here or there may add other skills elsewhere in that person's, you know, toolbox, I guess. And I think that's so important.
And since we're a sports podcast, I suppose we should quickly touch on the sport aspect as well.
Sure.
How much of a healer has that been for your brain? Is that you've always got, be it gym, which you touched upon earlier, and the football to turn to kind of focus your energy at?
I think whatever stage of life I'm at, whether I'm, you know, stressing over writing my book, or, you know, the night before I just self-harmed or been to A&E, football is always there the day after. It's always somewhere where you can just literally forget about everything else that's going on inside your head, because if you switch off in the football game, like, you will just get destroyed. So I think, like, for me, it's been a great focus. Some days I wouldn't get out of bed unless I had training or a game. I think for a lot of people, you know, sport is that release, but for me, it's been, you know, a true lifesaver at times. And yeah, I'm excited for where it's going to go, and you know, it's a great way of focusing in my energy and you know, my drive and determination that I've developed over the years from my mental health struggles, you know, only are a positive thing for me in my sport. And yeah, I think it's been a real genuine sort of like lifesaver to me, as I keep saying. Whether it's be the people that you're able to connect with, whether it be the lack of judgment, because no one really cares about anything but the game. I just think that, you know, football has such a responsibility in itself to support people's mental health. And you know, with sort of under 45s, males being the top sort of group of people to end their lives themselves, I think football has a responsibility in that way, in that, you know, the majority of football fans are men of that age. And, you know, it shouldn't be something that we shy away from. I think football clubs, you know, need to start taking things seriously, and both in their players and in their fans as well. And I think we're starting to get there, but, you know, there's a real long way to go.
That's what I was going to say. Are you starting to see football clubs and society kind of take notice, and that they should be doing something to actually raise awareness, whereas before, and I suppose it's probably still too widespread, is that people too often shy away from it, because it's a very awkward thing to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the steps are being made and the discussions are there. Like the EFL, you know, recently partnered with Mind, which I think is a great move. But at the same time, I think what I find really frustrating is players will open up about their mental health, about their struggle with depression or whatever, and I mean, very rarely is it a player who's still playing. Billy Key was a recent example at Accrington, who's still playing and has opened up about his mental health struggles. But, you know, a lot of players only open up once they've retired. And I think, you know, obviously I still play and I've opened up a lot. I think that needs to be a key. Like, you never hear of players who are off, you know, for a week or two because they're trying to look after their mental health, you know, but you hear about players who've, you know, got a little tweak in their ankle and, you know, they're off for 2 weeks. I think they need to be on the same terms. Obviously, we know about Aaron Lennon. That, again, like, he, you know, I mean, fair enough, you don't have to talk about it, but you know, you don't really hear much about how he's doing on a personal level. You just sort of look at the results and the, you know, the statistics about how he's doing in his football life, but you know, he could still be struggling. We don't know. And I think one thing for me is, like, once the players opened up, you know, about when they were struggling, you know, an ex-pro has opened up, you know, I would love to see them do more to then raise awareness and help players who are maybe going through similar things. A lot of players do. I'm good friends with Liam McKenzie, who does a lot to help professionals who are coming to the end of their career. But I'd love to see more of that, and obviously players opening up whilst they're still playing, because there's literally no shame at all.
Exactly. I mean, I see someone like Clark Carlisle,
yep,
who's obviously gone through a lot of things himself.
Uh-huh.
But even players like Frank Kirby and, yep, and Karen Carney, who've opened up about it in the past.
Yep.
But because of this whole man-up persona,
yep,
do you think that's why it's maybe harder to open up on the men's side, and why they don't talk about it so often?
Yeah, potentially. I think, yeah, I mean, you know, it's something like in the changing room, is something that you just would never talk about. It's such a macho and manly environment, that I imagine talking about anything along those lines, or about anything, or sort of expressing any kind of weakness, which people see it as, you know, is challenging. And I think we need to create an environment for the players where, you know, it's okay to have a bad day, it's okay to struggle in some way, it's okay to cry, like, that's okay, that's fine. I think a lot needs to be done in the way that, you know, clubs are run, and the environment that's created, and the atmosphere for players, so that they can, you know, feel more at home and comfortable in opening up to people.
In terms of your own football career, now that your struggles are out there, yeah, in the open,
uh-huh,
do you think you've improved now because it's a massive weight off your shoulders?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's always something that was holding me back. So a lot of self-doubt and my self-esteem was, you know, right at the bottom. To be honest, I didn't even think I was going to get through the next day. So how was I meant to, you know, get my head in gear to focus on the Sunday's game or whatever? So I think now I've got, like, almost like a release. Like, my whole horizons have just opened up, and I'm really excited for what the future has to hold. You know, I still do take it day by day, as I've said, but to be able to see the future, to be able to say, look, my book is published in September, is a real massive, massive step for me, because, you know, I couldn't see beyond the next hour, let alone day. So, yeah, I think football's been a really great focus throughout my whole journey, but particularly now when, you know, when I can actually hone in and focus on it entirely, I think, you know, it only makes me excited for what the future has to offer.
And lastly, before we wrap up, as hard as it's been, everything you've gone through,
yeah,
has it been the making of you, essentially?
I think so. I think I've now got a purpose in life. Like, for, you know, over a year, I was stuck in this who am I kind of place, and, you know, I didn't even know what I was doing or who I was, because, you know, my path in life had been, you know, changed, but not because I wanted to change it, because I was struggling with something that I couldn't help. And for me, you know, this is my purpose. You know, if I'm able to share my story with people and help someone else in a similar situation, then absolutely, my whole entire struggle, including the darkest moments, you know, are worth it in my eyes. So yeah, I'm just hoping to make an impact on as many people as possible, and hopefully help pull someone back from that dark place.
Yeah, absolutely. And then with that, we better finish up this episode. And I just want to thank you so much for coming on.
No worries.
And telling us your story. And honestly, I urge everyone to read your book, because, I mean, I've never read a book so quickly, I don't think.
Yeah.
But it's something that, obviously, going through things myself, it resonates with a lot of people,
mm-hmm,
regardless of whether you're in football or not. It's just something that,
yeah,
anyone can relate to. So thanks so much for also writing that, and also coming on here and sharing your story on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.